Hello and welcome to the EdSpace podcast. Ollie Bielas here. In this episode, Lewis Stockwell and I are speaking with Neil Hopkins. Neil has a long-standing interest in democratic education, and as you'll hear, he's been trying to shift his research recently from the relative abstractions of political philosophy, though I'm not entirely convinced Neil's work has ever really been as ungrounded as he makes out. But he's been trying to, as he sees it, shift from the relative abstractions of political philosophy to examples of what he sees as philosophy in action, or lived philosophy. The focus of our conversation is Neil's recent article on Henry Morris and the Cambridgeshire Village College system, which emerged in the first half of the 20th century, that and the lessons that we might still learn from Morris and his vision. Enjoy.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, natural. That, yeah, this, as if for the first time. How are you both?
I'm good. Good in the circumstances.
Yeah, living the dream.
Yeah. What have you both been doing to keep yourselves busy?
I've taken up more cycling, so it's a bit more cycle friendly around here than my previous place. So I've been doing more cycling, Ollie.
Where is here?
Well, round the sort of like the Ouse, so kind of from St Ives towards Cambridge. I've been cycling kind of round that way.
Right. Yes, because we spoke, didn't we? We spoke about back in the olden times. We talked about taking a canoe from
Bedford
through to you, didn't we?
Yeah, you can do it.
We will do it when we're allowed back on the water.
Yeah, I don't know how long that would take. How long would it take? About 4 or 5 hours, or
a bit more than that.
A bit more.
You know, look for a good day's paddle. That.
Okay.
What have you been doing, Lewis? Now that you can't paddle, have you set your canoe up in the living room?
No, but I have actually. I have at some point set the canoe up in the garden.
Yeah.
And some friends did pretend to go paddling. Other than that, building bug hotels.
What?
What I'm doing. Bug hotels. You know what these are?
Not really.
No.
These things that, yeah, I think I've seen them in like nature reserves and stuff, I think.
Yeah. So like lots of sticks put together. So like bugs have little kind of cracks and crevices.
Yeah.
Or into logs and stuff.
Yeah, I've seen those.
Yeah. That's what I've been doing.
I think for on my phone, you cut out just for a second there, right when you're about to tell me what a bug hotel is.
It's
still a secret to me.
A bug hotel is like an artificial but semi-natural home for garden bugs. So you can often drill into, say, bits of wood or use bamboo. And bees often make solitary bees will like make their nest in the hollow of the bamboo or something like that. Solitary wasps might make their home in some very small kind of gap. So that's what I've been doing.
That sounds brilliant. You could make a documentary about it and call it the Grand Bug and Pest Hotel.
Yeah. Yeah.
We should talk about Neil's article, shouldn't we?
If we must.
Yes. Yes.
So the focus of this episode is your soon to be published, right? Or is it out? Is it available online already?
Available online already, Ollie. It just doesn't have a volume or issue number yet.
Okay.
A bit like that.
Right. Yeah, I do. Yeah. So we'll make sure there's a link and that the DOI appears on the site.
Okay.
But the article is focused on a man called Henry Morris.
Yep.
And his Cambridge Village Colleges plan. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the one.
So summarize it for us.
Okay. So Morris was came into sort of educational administration after the First World War, took over what the role wasn't. The role as it now stands in terms of chief education officer is given a slightly different title, but he basically became chief education officer of Cambridgeshire in the early 1920s and had this quite radical plan. I mean, he wrote this thing called the Memorandum in 1924, so quite soon after he had actually taken on the role, and essentially saw education and educational institutions as a means of empowering and revivifying local cultures. So he was very, very concerned. I mean, we have to remember we're talking of a pre-mechanistic, pre kind of car owning culture. So, you know, people were slightly more isolated perhaps than they are now, into their sort of specific geographical areas, villages or towns or whatever. But essentially what he wanted to do was avoid rural Cambridgeshire towns and villages from becoming husks of what they could be because of the power of Cambridge and other towns and cities attracting people and leaving these Cambridgeshire towns and villages sort of derelict effectively over time. And he saw the village college plan as a means of transforming village and town life in Cambridgeshire. So the reason why I find it powerful is it's this idea of education as genuinely political and genuinely community focused, in an age where in a sense it's a rejoinder or an antidote to this idea of education being quite functional, quite instrumental, neoliberal. I mean, it's this Morris is an antidote to that, I think, in a lot of ways.
That's really, really interesting, because this is, so I know that you've said on a number of occasions now that you, I don't think this is quite right, but you've said of yourself, of your work, that you think it's been quite abstract, and where you've been perhaps more focused on the philosophical aspects, you feel that you've been working at quite a high level of abstraction, and, yeah, and you're becoming increasingly interested in concrete examples of radical educational projects or democratic educational projects in action. And this is one example of that, right?
I mean, you've quoted me almost word for word. I mean, that's been a concern, if I'm being critical. I mean, I've been concerned about the trajectory of what I've been writing and thinking about for some time, in the sense that, you know, it's interesting as political theory. And it's interesting from, as you say, from an abstract point of view, Ollie, but, you know, where's the concrete evidence of it? Where's the proof on the ground? So, I mean, you know, having moved to this kind of area and talking to, you know, slowly talking to people in this area who are familiar with the plan and, you know, the village college plan and the aftermaths of that, it's an interesting look at, in terms of the reality, the concrete reality of some of the ideas I've been reading about and advocating actually on the ground, and frankly some of the difficulties that such things encompass when they're formulated in reality.
Well, that seems like a natural, that seems to lead us naturally into, what are those difficulties?
Well, I think what we've got.
And were you talking about difficulties then or now?
Well,
if we were trying to do a similar project now, or are you thinking about both?
It's a bit of both. I mean, the problems Morris had at the time were opposition from what we might call the squirearchy. So, I mean, Cambridgeshire at that time was very much, you know, it was aristocratic. It was landowner in terms of the county council. I mean, the county council essentially didn't want Morris's plan. I mean, they refused to fund it. So he had political opposition from a sort of a more class, overt class sort of perspective then. I think now, they're not exactly the same difficulties now, but I think that the difficulties we have now, Ollie, is that that kind of localism is quite difficult to advocate and formulate, where we've got national education systems that have a whole administrative structure around them and are frankly assessed against other education systems now, aren't they? In the form of PISA and TIMSS and all sorts of other things. So that kind of localism that Morris was encapsulating comes up against this huge juggernaut that is the, you know, the education administrative state, for want of a better word.
Yeah, I suppose it's worth mentioning, isn't it, with that in mind, that so many of the village colleges have now been absorbed in, this is right, isn't it, have now been absorbed in the academies anyhow.
Yeah, they're all part of academy chains pretty much now.
Yep. Has that affected the way they function? I mean, are they anything, are they village colleges in a form that Morris would recognise, or in name only?
That's very interesting, because in a sense, this paper is only part of the story. And what I'm planning to do, and I'm in the process of doing, Ollie, is looking at a kind of a follow-up in whatever guise, I'm not sure yet, but to actually talk to people on the ground in the colleges, you know, and their academies, to see how much of Morris's vision is still credible or followed through. So in a sense, it's kind of almost watched this space. I suppose the paper that we're talking about now is almost like the theoretical part, or the theoretical part, I suppose, is the best way of putting it. The second part, if you like, is actually, as I say, talking to people on the ground and seeing if academisation or similar has had a detrimental effect on the village college movement and them as institutions. I mean, a lot of critics have said it has, but I would quite like to, and that's what I'm saying, I plan to go out and interview those on the ground who know what they're talking about and have involvement with the village colleges, and see if that is the case, or whether, you know, academisation isn't quite the bogeyman that some people have argued that it is.
Because I guess there's the potential in within the academy structure, isn't there? There's the potential to use it to preserve that kind of autonomy, to opt out elements of the national curriculum. So
absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's, yeah, what I suspect the government, if we had a government minister here, that's what they would argue. And I think you're right. I mean, I think my concern is more, I mean, to talk a bit about the village colleges, is it's important to envisage them as more than just schools. So, I mean, Morris never saw them as schools. In fact, he saw the word school as actually a pejorative term, to the extent of, you know, actually Morris visiting one of the village colleges and saying to the head, this is like an effing school. You know, So for Morris, village colleges were essentially educational institutions, educational hubs for lifelong learning. I mean, Morris was an early advocate of lifelong learning, although the term wasn't used then as it is now. But that's essentially what he was advocating and talking about. So village colleges were sites for learning throughout a person's life. And I think it's, I think, Ollie, where the biggest difficulties have occurred is probably in the adult education aspect. I mean, I think the compulsory school aspect also has its problems in terms of what Morris would see and envisage. But the way that adult education has been really, really kind of hit in terms of support, that's where I think he would be most concerned, and that in effect the village colleges have become maybe too much like schools rather than as lifelong institutions.
Yeah.
So Neil, what kinds of learning would have happened, or what kind of education would have happened inside the village colleges then? What was the main focus of them, and what were they offering, what was going on?
I mean, it's interesting pedagogically. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, Morris was never a teacher, which is quite interesting. He never actually taught and purportedly was found the company of kids quite difficult, apparently, which is an irony. I mean, Morris, although Morris never acknowledged Dewey particularly, and I say this in the paper, I mean, it's, you know, if you look at Morris's writings, I don't think there's any reference from the writings I've looked at of Morris that talk of Dewey, but there's actually quite a lot of similarities between them. I mean, Morris certainly played, saw a huge benefit in the arts. Where we talk about what he'd have thought now, he would be very, very upset by the way that literature and the creative and applied arts are downplayed in most school curriculums now, I think. Well, if I know, because Morris actually even had artists in residence in the village colleges. So he actually advocated that. So you'd actually have a trained artist within every one of these village colleges. Also the crafts as well. He was very, very positive about what we might call as, you know, the practical arts, crafts.
So the artisan.
Yeah. Crafts, yeah. And not just for purely aesthetic reasons. I mean, you know, again, we're talking of a county at the time that was essentially rural and agricultural. And these crafts, these hand skills, for want of a better word, would have also had practical economic value as well. But he certainly didn't believe that. Well, sir, put it this way, he would have had little or no truck with this emphasis we have now on English, maths and science. I think he had a much more holistic, much more expansive view of what a valuable, enriching curriculum consists of. And the manual arts, the crafts, the creative arts would have played a huge part in that. Alongside the humanities as well. I mean, history and geography. I think, again, he would be absolutely crestfallen with how history and geography, for example, and philosophy and religious education, how they have been minimised in most school curricula now because of this juggernaut that is English, maths and science that we've talked about, you know, through international comparisons and, you know, inspectorate requirements.
I think that's really interesting because one of the things that that I think people are concerned about now is, you know, they want the very best for their children or even the very best for themselves. So in Cambridge, of course, it might be, or at least in Cambridgeshire, that they want their children or they themselves want to go to Cambridge, you know, enjoy that rather, you know, aesthetic life, intellectual life. Was the kind of education in the colleges, was it one that was trying to emulate what was happening in the city, or is it something that's also distinct from it as well in saying that you don't just have to have that kind of liberal education? There's actually more to this whole learning community in the college.
Well, I think he was certainly very, very what we think of as liberal education, Lewis. He was very amenable to. I mean, he lived in Cambridge, he studied in Cambridge, he was based in Cambridge, you know, Shire Hall. That kind of liberal, and frankly, there is that slightly kind of elitist kind of, I don't know, paternal whiff about Morris. I mean, whether that's a sign of the times or whether that's a character trait, but yeah, I mean, there are huge aspects of Cambridge and what we would think of as Cambridge life, the whole Brideshead Revisited kind of thing, that he was very, very amenable to and very, very sympathetic to. So that's why, as you say, the liberal idea, the arts, self-discovery, you know, through learning was something he found very congenial. However, he was also a realist and realised that, frankly, most students who went to the village colleges would not end up at Cambridge. Very few of them.
Okay.
Certainly then, I mean, less so now. I think there's a much closer connection between the university and the colleges now, and because of just for all sorts of reasons. But at the time when he was instituting these, Lewis, you know, most of the kids would have ended up on the land, or related industries or related, you know, practices. So he was also a realist and realised that, you know, animal husbandry, some kind of early kind of agro-economics, agricultural practices, those sorts of things had to play a part as well. I mean, there was a vocational aspect to it. And Morris didn't have a problem with that. I mean, he didn't, you know, that's what I'm saying. He's quite akin to Dewey in a lot of ways. Although I think he's much more, there's much more of a kind of a paternal aspect perhaps to Morris than Dewey, because he was an administrator, whereas Dewey was a philosopher and academic. They're different roles.
Yeah.
But Morris did see the benefits of relatable, realistic, needed vocational education. So he certainly wasn't a believer in just pure liberal education as we would understand it for the sake of it, because he didn't think that by itself would be enough for the students from Cambridgeshire villages and towns who would end up in these colleges.
But there is that line for, is it from the memorandum, yeah, which was that 1924, right? And there is that line. So in 1924 already we've got Morris, another link with Dewey here, we've got Morris, like Dewey, challenging that idea of an easy division between the vocation, the so-called vocational and the so-called academic, haven't we? That he recognises that split but seeks to challenge it. And in one of the passages you quote, he says, "The dismal dispute of vocational and non-vocational education would not arise in it being the village college." Yeah.
So he had a much more would see holistic them. View, Ollie. Yeah. And I think what we would think of as maybe project-based learning or creative curriculum or cross-curricular activity, I think Morris was much more, again, probably much more amenable to that than your typical educationist of the time. And, you know, maybe some of the theorists now around, you know, who are advocating a very strong subject-based, knowledge-rich curriculum for various reasons, I think Morris would probably push back and say, well, actually, like Dewey, you know, these subject compartments, these subject silos, if we can call them that, you know, we don't learn that way. I think he had this view that, you know, disciplines could cross over, could transfer, and actually, like Dewey, when applied, when we're putting learning and knowledge into application, we are always using more than one disciplinary knowledge base for that. So he saw this distinction between application and theory, like Dewey, as essentially a false dichotomy.
Do you think it's possible that he wasn't aware of Dewey's work, or do you think he just wasn't, because he's not an academic, he's not fussed to he's not fussed to nod to his influences?
I think I'm listening, reading people who knew Morris and who wrote about Morris. He knew Dewey full well, Dewey. I mean, he was familiar with Dewey. I mean, Dewey was, you know, writing at a time when Morris started to come into maturity in terms of his own thoughts and his own implementing his own ideas. I think it's a possible character flaw, Ollie, in that he wasn't willing to acknowledge sources. You know, I think there was this idea that these, you know, he was initiating these ideas from scratch, and there are other, I mean, we haven't got time to discuss this, but there were other instances with other people and other trends where he wasn't willing to acknowledge their influence either. So there was obviously something in his psychological makeup that made him unable to really properly acknowledge where he got his ideas from, you know. I think the other thing with Morris that's interesting isn't just the curriculum side to things, although that's really important, but the other thing that I got from it, and possibly is even more important in the paper, is this idea of village colleges as being sites of citizenship and democracy. So yeah. Remember, he's writing at a time when the franchise is expanding. You've got full male franchise. You're starting to get slowly, I think by 1928, full female franchise. And what Morris is worried about is that, I mean, basically what he's looking at, and whether we can see this as exemplary or as, again, slightly patrician, but he's looking for activated citizenship in local communities. So the village college isn't just a mechanism for learning curricula. For Morris, through civic society, through community activity, he wants village colleges to effectively invigorate local democracy. And that's why I think the vision is more than just, that's why he never sees the village college as a school, because his view of school is this idea of getting children through a curriculum and at the other side, you know, almost factory based. And Morris wants to push massively against that. He wants the village college to be, in effect, a hub, a forum, a centre for local conversation, debate, engagement, and ultimately, when you put all those together, local democracy.
And this is outside of, say, kind of the guiding hand of local government, isn't it? So this is what I think you call in a paper, is it association?
Yeah, I mean, well, this is the interesting thing. So, I mean, just to very, very briefly talk about, so I introduce associationism into the article, and associationism it's a long-standing idea. I mean, its heritage, you know, in various shapes and forms goes back a long way. But I mean, in its contemporary form, I mean, I used the work of Paul Hurst, who was writing in the 90s. And essentially, Lewis, what associationism is this idea of public services being controlled and, in a sense, owned by the local user groups, for want of a better word, local society, to get public services away from this kind of gargantuan, bureaucratic, monolithic national state that he was seeing. So, you know, whether that's in medicine, whether that's in social services and social care, whether it's education, you know, emergency services, whatever. So you've got some kind of links there. So I was trying to sort of use political theory around what Hurst was saying to sort of look at where Morris sort of fits in with contemporary sort of political theory on the idea of localism, really, and also grassroots public services and there are tensions there. So there are things about associationism where Morris would concur, would see links, certainly in terms of the local community having a significant, if not the predominant, say in what is taught and learnt and studied within the village colleges. You know, control, you know, from a kind of a management point of view, of the village colleges from in terms of local population. So a lot of these kinds of ideas that we would associate with modern localism. However, of course, Morris was himself a bureaucrat. And that's the tension. That's the ultimate paradox, is Morris is an apparatchik in a sense. I mean, he is ensconced in Shire Hall in Cambridge. You know, he's employed by Cambridgeshire County Council. And, you know, there is an element of him dictating what he thinks is the best vision for the village colleges. So there's this tension between him as a bureaucrat and him as a theorist. In you know, although he wouldn't necessarily see himself as a theorist, but as a theorist of some kind of localism for public services.
Yeah, that's really helpful to kind of get to grips with that, because one of the things that I keeps going around in my mind is that because he doesn't see the village college as a school, and that there are different, for want of a better term, stakeholders using and engaging with the village college and also the idea of the village college as well. So, you know, they've got the bricks and mortar and also what it should be doing in the community. I was wondering who does he see leading, you know, the village colleges and their multi functionality, I suppose. So is it teachers who, as you know, as pedagogical public intellectuals, educating different crafts and practices, and
who appoints the artist in residence?
Are the leaders as well, you know, are they the association leaders too?
I think
what you know about that.
It's a very, very insight to that point, and I think has a particularly well developed view on. Well, he says things in the memorandum about, you know, the kinds of people who should be involved or could be involved, but I mean, he doesn't have a sophisticated stakeholder theory, Lewis, like we might find in a lot of contemporary theory, you know, whether it's Will Hutton or other theorists who have spoken about stakeholders. I mean, he's not, because he didn't write an awful lot, and I don't think he saw himself as a theorist because of where he's positioned himself. He's more of an administrator than a theorist. In his view, he didn't necessarily sort of develop these ideas around power. I don't think Morris has a very strong, and this is possibly a weakness in his plan and in his ideas. He doesn't have a very strong theory of power. And I think that's possibly, well, that's certainly one of the major criticisms that can be and has been levelled against him.
Is that also anything to do with the fact that, as you've talked about, some of the tensions in Morris between, you know, tensions that are sort of fairly typical of classical liberalism, right? But is that also to do with Morris seeing himself very much at the centre of all this anyway?
Yeah, and I think the thing is Ollie, I think he saw, whether he was, you know, conscious of the paradox. I mean, at the end of the day, he's advocating local democracy and the idea of village colleges as being the centre of these sort of, in a sense, as exemplars of local democracy or as hubs of local democracy and the education within them. But ultimately, they were done at the behest of a bureaucrat who was determining where they were to occur and when. You know, that's not to say that it wasn't at the behest of local communities to sort of lobby for these things, but there is this tension, and I think it's a tension that, in a sense, it's a tension that a lot of political parties who have educational theories or policies that are or manifestos that are sympathetic to local democracy and schools as being or colleges as being sort of these centres of the local community, but then do you give them their head? Mm. You know, do you allow them to, you know, veer off? I mean, what's interesting, isn't it, is that we've seen to some extent a slightly watered down tension around this with the federalization of education in this country, haven't we? Where, you know, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland have now got their own administrations, mm-hmm. and can determine their own educational policies, and the kind of confusion and anger in some cases that's formed because of that, you know. And I think because we've had this very, very centralized education system, particularly for the last, well, certainly since the 80s, if not before, maybe even, we can even see it maybe with Callaghan in the late 70s even, you know, for the last 40, 50 years, we've seen this, you know, this kind of evolution of a national education system. And in a sense, it's that tension between equality and community, isn't it? I mean, do we as a society want education to be equal in the sense of entitlement, in a sense of what children receive, if that's the right word? Should that be standardized, or do we need, because if we give localism its head, if we give local communities their some kind of power, inevitably they're going to go off into areas that are of interest to them and of importance to them that might not be to other areas of the country. And I think Morris and the Cambridgeshire experiment is a microcosm of that. You know, you've got somebody at the centre, you know, of a local state, if you like, in the form of a county council, and educational institutions that are purportedly local, you know, are supposed to be exemplars of local democracy, but how much democracy are they allowed? You know, and I don't think in a sense, academisation's been sold as that, hasn't it? Not to that extent, but this whole idea of we are giving power back to
and also with the idea and the idea of the free school, which is a special kind of academy, isn't it? I think
precisely, you know, I mean, absolutely, Ollie. I mean, it's this tension, isn't it, between, you know, regulation, standardisation, and local need and local wants and local rights. And I, you know, Morris was arguing a point of view and putting into practice, you know, this view, this vision. And we've seen others, whether it's, you know, in the form of, you know, schools like Summerhill, or schools in what we might call the anarchist tradition, or free schools. There's this constant tension. And that's why I think Morris is still pertinent now, because partly from what we discussed earlier about the curriculum and, you know, whether it's subject based or whether it can be more, you know, more multidisciplinary, for want of a better word. So there's that kind of tension that Morris still helps to encapsulate, but also around power, around, you know, who determines what goes on in those institutions.
I know he doesn't, I know you don't talk about this in the paper as such, but there is another tension, which when I was reading the paper, I kept going back to like the ideas of romantic forms of education, you know, going, augmenting, you know, the local enabling the local knowledge and augmenting nature. I didn't go as far back as Rousseau, but I think there is, you know, there's some interesting connections there as well. I don't know whether you had any views on that, because he does seem to want to celebrate the local.
Yeah,
which in the case for Cambridge is also a kind of a form of natural as well. I imagine he would see it as that's he celebrates that as a view, but also he's got this tension that he is also part of and espouses a particular viewpoint from being a bureaucrat, which is again incompatible with that kind of romantic vision, if it is indeed one.
Yeah, and I think. Certainly, I think Morris. I mean, if we see romanticism, I mean, as I mean, are you talking about romanticism, Lewis, in the sense of what we might think of as Bildung and education as personal growth, personal development, learning from nature, that kind of
learning nature, learning at one's natural pace, and things like, because he does talk about the pedagogic fallacy as well, doesn't he?
Absolutely.
We shouldn't be pushed beyond our abilities at the particular point, and that our learning should be intellectual and aesthetic. So that's kind of how I'm envisaging romanticism there.
Yeah, and I think certainly if we think of people like Pestalozzi and Rousseau to a degree, although, you know, Rousseau's view of any kind of organised education under a roof is problematic. Yeah. I mean, certainly in Emile. But I think you're absolutely right. I mean, partly it's because Cambridgeshire at the time was primarily a rural entity anyway, but I think Morris, from his writings, and certainly when you look at the village colleges, nature does play an important part in that, you know, and children were encouraged to grow things, to, you know, there were, you know, to with your animals around, and you know, the very fact that the grounds themselves were supposed to epitomize this sort of, you know, whether it's a garden or more than that. But I think he was again amenable to that. I mean, there's not a great deal in the writings themselves. I think we have to go to the actual buildings. And I mean, if you look at something like Sawston, was his first village college in 1930. It was very much kind of modelled on the Cambridge College cloister kind of thing, you know, that, you know, whether it was St John's or King's or, you know, whatever, whichever the college is. It's so, yeah, I mean, I think what I'm trying to say is he was very amenable to that without, again, it being necessarily very clearly formulated in any sort of body of writing. It was more a case of what was happening on the ground. And that's why partly I'm interested in pursuing that, because it's what's happening on the ground. I mean, it's that very concreteness, the fact that, you know, Morris didn't necessarily write a lot about what you've said, Lewis, but in terms of his actions and what went on and what hopefully does continue to go on, there's an embodiment of that in bricks and mortar and in fields and, you know, in pedagogies around that. Mm.
That's really interesting. Really, really interesting.
But because he wrote relatively little, I mean, his collective writings are meagre, really. I mean, they don't amount to very much. Maybe 150 pages. Oh. You know, tiny, tiny. A lot of what we're talking about has to be kind of inferred or glossed or kind of extrapolated from, because ultimately I think he was more of a doer in that mm-hmm. sense. I think because he was more of an administrator rather than, say, your Deweys and others who were contemporaneous with him, who were thinkers in that sense. I mean, Morris was a thinker, don't get me wrong, but a lot of his thinking went into the actual you know, the actual embodiments, the actual concrete physical structures and what went on inside, rather than a lot of voluminous writing on the subject. I mean, things like, let me give you an example. I mean, to show you the importance of the arts in terms of Morris's view of, he actually commissioned Walter Gropius, who was the head of the Bauhaus before essentially they all had to leave when the Nazis took over. He actually commissioned Gropius to build Impington College. And Impington Village College, according to Nicholas Pevsner, is one of the finest examples of Bauhaus architecture in England.
Wow.
So, you know, and that building is still there, 1939, it's still there, you know. And so that's what I'm saying. And I mean, actually, that's something perhaps I haven't talked about as much, is the Morris has this sort of incredible passion about architecture, which is kind of expand on the view you're making about Romanticism. It's the architecture, the ambience. Yeah, the very ambience.
Environment.
Sorry?
The environment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, architecture, you know, he has this sort of almost messianic kind of view of the architecture of a village college and the importance that the architecture plays, and that children should be around beautiful things, basically.
Is that maybe that's the sort of driving force, though, then? The some sort of maybe not... possibly not well articulated idea of beauty rather than, say, nature, because
the
Gropius design college, I mean, that would be in that sort of bringing modernism right into Cambridgeshire, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And what's fascinating,
and modernity, I mean, it's interesting that this has all been spearheaded by an administrator, because there's a sort of that's a kind of technology, isn't it, as well? There's a technocracy at work here as well as an aesthetics, and, well, the two aren't necessarily opposed. Is that making any sense? I'm just garbling.
Yeah. And I think what's fascinating is if you compare Sawston in 1930, a very modelled on a very traditional view of what we think of as university college, kind of, you know, with the cloister, the green square, you know, there's a little fountain or sundial in the middle of it, you know, you walk around the cloister, and in fact, you know, even the headmaster was referred to as a warden, you know, they're not even a headmaster or a headmistress or whatever. If you compare that in 1930 to Impington in 1939, where, as you say, I mean, you've gone from something that's very traditional in Sawston to something that's at the forefront of modernist architecture in terms of Impington, you know. But I think what Morris, the beauty thing is really important. I'm not sure how fleshed out Morris's view of that was, although I suspect what I've read is it's fairly traditional, you know, in the sense of beauty as it was kind of probably epitomised by Matthew Arnold, right, or other theorists of, you know, from the Victorian period. I think he was a Victorian in that sense. But, you know, so it's this idea of beauty, and that, you know, children of any walk of life should be exposed to beauty. You know, and any education that doesn't foster that, for Morris, is a dereliction of duty, really.
That also links back to Dewey as well, you know, in experience and education, the interaction view that, you know, you're in the environment, and the quality of the environment, the objective quality of the environment is going to have a serious influence.
Absolutely. On
the development of that learning.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting, you know, how little Morris made of Dewey, and how little was actually the connections. I mean, I was talking to someone from the Henry Morris Trust, Peter Haynes, who's, you know, was a head teacher and is, you know, does a lot with the Henry Morris Trust now, which is basically a trust to continue Morris's legacy, essentially. And he was saying, you know, how little connection has been made between Dewey and Morris, which is weird when, as you've rightly said, there seems to be so many connections between them. You know, they're very different characters. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, the two were doing, I'm sure that, I don't know much about the Chicago Laboratory School, but I'm sure it's probably very different from a Cambridgeshire Village College, if, you know, in some ways. But, you know, the similarities between their views on what education should be is remarkably, there's a remarkable kind of connection there that doesn't seem to have been fully exploited, in my view, for reasons I, you know, I'm not really sure why that's not been made, but I think the connections are glaring.
What I'm just keeping half an eye on the time here. What if any lessons are there then for us? You know, for us now. That's a terrible question, but I mean, you. One of the questions you raise in the article is, you know, what's the relevance of Morris's project to us today? What do you want us to take from this, or do you see a preferable model for education and schooling? I mean, you raised a number of questions 10 minutes ago, you know, things like, well, if we're going to devolve an education system, how far do we go? How much autonomy do we, you know, how local do we go with our education system? How fractured do we allow it to become, and so on and so on. Do you have any answers to those?
Well, I think Morris sort of asks two things of us, and I'm not sure there are simple answers, Ollie, but I think the two questions that Morris asks us are, firstly, how is there such a thing as lifelong education? And if there is, how do we pursue it? Because for Morris, the village college was the place in which that took place. So is learning a lifelong activity? And if it is, you know, can we put all of that under one roof, or has it inevitably got to be fractured or diversified or whatever? Because Morris saw the village college as the hub of that, really. You know, that was where it would take place, all learning within, you know, or that would be the hub where most, if not all, learning in that area would take place. So there's that notion. And then the second notion, which is kind of aligned to that, is, can we see educational institutions as epitomes of local democracy? Should we see them as that? Our schools, our colleges, or whatever we want to call them, Ollie, are they political? And I mean political in the widest sense. You know, are schools, like Dewey was arguing, like Morris is arguing, are they in a sense laboratories for democracy, or are they something else? And I think that's one of the fundamental questions that Dewey was asking, and equally in an English context that Morris was arguing, that they are, you know, the educational institutions are inherently political, and we should celebrate that.
And would it be fair to say that, because I suspect sometimes that the sort of the guiding, what really drives your work, not just this piece, but your recent book on socialist democratic education and other work that you've produced, I get the feeling that you want the answer to that question to be yes, and you're trying to work out what it might look like.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And I think it's that hoary tension, if you like, between political education, or education is political and education is indoctrination, isn't it? Because where, unfortunately, some systems where education has been inherently political, Ollie, we have seen totalitarianism.
Yeah.
You know, and teachers have that worry, don't they? I mean, that's why I think teachers are so wary of education being political, because there's that fear, rightly, of indoctrination, you know, of it becoming, you know, either Lord of the Flies or 1984.
So there you go, Neil Hopkins on Henry Morris, the Cambridgeshire Village College system, and democratic education. What you didn't get at the end was 5 minutes of waffle, very nice waffle, but all very mutual appreciation society, so you don't really need to hear that, do you? I will say, though, that you miss Lewis and me telling Neil how much, genuinely how much we enjoyed reading his piece on Morris and the college system, and the village college system. We can't recommend it enough. It's a really engaging and sensitive piece of work, and a great example of academic writing that'll be accessible to a wide readership. And that's something that Neil's long been concerned with. And I think it's yet another indicator, if one were needed, of the democratic impulse that runs through all his work. What else did you miss? You missed us talking briefly about William Blake and his importance as a radical thinker on, among other things, education. So somewhere down the line, perhaps we'll be able to put something together on Blake and education. That'd be nice. I think that about does it. Thanks again to Neil and Lewis, without whom the podcast would be a very different beast. 2 minute episodes probably of me mumbling inchoately about not very much in particular. Have a gander at Neil's article. It's a cracking piece, as Lewis and I have said repeatedly. We've posted a link to the article on the EdSpace page at Anchor FM. If you can't access the article, then maybe drop Neil a line. Authors are usually given a certain number of free PDFs or tokens, as it were, that they're allowed to share. Thanks very much for listening. I was about to say see you next time, but I won't, because it's a podcast. Bye.